got it. Here we go. Lots and lots of news to get to. Tommy.
Tommy!
Are you going to start?
Wow. Yes.
I guess our
summer days are dwindling down, John.
Really? Wow. I didn't know you were going to go weather. I thought you'd do more sports. I thought I'd get a Seahawks out of you. Diving in the news! I really thought I'd get a C, but no.
Seahawks!
No. Too late. You went weather.
That's because I know what our top story is.
I know, but I thought maybe you could lead into it and give me a little bit of a chance. I remember one time watching King 5 News, and it was the day after the summer solstice, and Gene Henderson said, well, from this time on, the days are getting shorter. I thought, wow. just killing the whole vibe. But I guess you're doing the same thing. This is it, Tom. Summer
it's
waning.
Philosophical.
Yes, very true.
Speaking of philosophical, here he comes now, Mike Sock. Mr. Morning Show Sports Guy.
Congratulations on the big, was it a demotion, promotion? I don't know. You used to be our boss, and I turn around, next thing I know, hey, he's on the air. So there he's back again. ESPN 710, Mike Sock in there. You've got to be happy that the football season has started again. You don't have to talk Mariners or anything else. Although, you are also a huge hockey fan, so you are probably with bated breath waiting for the Krakens to drop the puck there at center ice.
Wow, I got like five things to respond to already.
Moving on to the
first
Seahawks.
The weather.
I was both promoted and demoted. Let's be very clear. Both things happened at once.
Okay,
second
good.
Of all, no one's more happy to talk Mariners than me, and they're actually still right there hanging on the edge of the playoff
That's
spot.
True.
And C,
okay.
I am very excited to talk Kraken, having grown up in the Northeast with hockey. So what
there
else you got, Tom?
Let's all go. That. No. Good. All the way around. All right, so let us talk Seahawks. Big surprise, not really, that we went to Indianapolis and we did what we did. Is there anything that stands out for you in the Seahawks game that you say, wow, this looks like a different team?
Yeah, actually, it's not a surprise that they won. It's generally never a surprise when the Seahawks win. They've been one of the better teams in football for about a decade now since Pete and Russ got together. I think what surprised me and some other folks was just how good and crisp their offense was. In the offseason, they went out and got themselves a new offensive coordinator. His name is Shane Waldron. And heading into the year, my thought was he's actually the most interesting, important, and in some ways, Seahawk that we know the least about, because the preseason, they didn't play any of their regular starters. We didn't really get a sense as to what his new offense looked like. And we know that Russell was unhappy in the offseason with where the offense had been over the last couple of years. So enter this new offensive coordinator. He had never called plays before. He came from a system where he had been with the Rams and Kyle Shanahan earlier in his career. So for him to show up and have this incredibly dynamic, complete, multiple, balanced offense that we saw yesterday, not that it was a surprise, but I think it was more than even just a sigh of relief. It was a huge bit of excitement for a team that looked good and now maybe even could look great.
You know, Mike, I am struck. I've lived most of my life as a sports fan in Seattle, and I don't think I've ever heard so many people tripping over themselves praising Shane Waldron and how great the new offense is. I'm really baffled. I understand that this could be the dawn of a new era, but everyone seems so convinced, from the journalists to the players themselves to Russell Wilson. Do you think that we might be embarrassing ourselves six games in? We might be looking back at all the encomiums we were throwing the Seahawks way and say, wait a minute, I think we overreacted to one game.
Well, movie buff that you are, I think you're subscribing to the Al Pacino theory of contrary opinion from Glengarry Glenn Ross, right? If everybody is going in one direction, I think
great movie.
The other way.
Very good movie.
Yes. So
I mean, really, we've had great blowout wins in the past.
It's all true, and you might be right about that, Tom, but Indy's a good defense. That we know. They were a playoff team a year ago mostly because of that good defense. And if you've watched the Seahawks game during those last 10 years, the defense has always kind of led the way. Russell's been great, but it always looks like their offense does not resemble any other team in the NFL. Like, they're just desperately trying to keep up. There's a free rusher, and Russell has to elude somebody and run around for 5 seconds and then make a miraculous throw, and just somehow they manage to pull it off at the end. And it didn't look like that yesterday. They looked in control. They looked in command.
True.
They did a lot of the things they've always done. They ran the ball well, and Chris Carson was good. They threw the ball deep, and Russ had those two big throws to Tyler Lockett. But it was the other throws that were what they say, and I don't use these words. These are like, you know, the Brock Heward words. They were on schedule, meaning the play did what it was called to do. Russell stepped back. He noticed who he wanted to throw to, and he threw it to him, and they completed the pass. And those sort of the gimmies, those easy receptions, they just haven't been there in the offense the last few years, and they absolutely were yesterday.
Okay, there was a lot of concern about our corners in the defense. Were they tested enough yesterday to reassure you, or do you think that that still could be the fly in the ointment?
Huge fly in the ointment, still not okay. Tested at all. I watched that entire game, and I still don't know who plays wide receiver for the Colts. I mean, like they do not have great weaponry on the outside. We'll see a little bit more next week when they host Tennessee. Julio Jones and A.J. Brown are both, you know, pretty marquee names in the NFL. Yeah. So you'll see them get tested a little bit more. Whereas the corners, we don't know much about. What I think did stand out, though, was the pressure they were able to put. Colts offensive line is really another of their strengths, and certainly on the offensive side of the ball, that's where they've made their money. And the Seahawks got to Carson Wentz. They were in the backfield all game long. Yeah. And it's not that they have one guy. It's not like they have a Lawrence Taylor who just dominates. They've got 5-6 guys who can all get to the quarterback, sub in for each other, keep each other fresh. And it was effective for them. We'll see if that continues.
Let's find out if Steve Vrabel was in good form.
Second down and 20. Russ steps up in the pocket, and he's going to let fly deep downfield. Got a man open. Lock it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Steve sounds good. How about something like, let's see how he calls this one on Chris Carson.
Third down and 1. Chris Carson gets a handoff inside. Breaks free. He's inside the 40, the 30. Knocked out of bounds.
All right, not bad. Carson rushes for 94 yards, stays healthy, and it seems like he runs like he... Remember Marshawn Lynch used to say, if someone's going to tackle me, they're going to feel it. I skipped all the F-bombs. But basically, it looked like Chris Carson was going to make sure that whoever tackled him would know that they tackled him. He ran very aggressively, and isn't this a guy that sometimes we're so afraid is going to get injured?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is sort of the up and, you know, it's the other side of the coin that comes with his level of physicality. But in the meantime, he just gives them a presence. Right. And he can wear you down over the course of a game. He may not be the featured part of their offense week in, week out. They were able to have success running the ball yesterday, which was great. And as you said, the 91 yards, whatever it was. But he is strong. He is physical. He runs mean. He runs angry. He comes at you. He doesn't avoid contact. And I think that's what Pete likes. He wants a running back who's not just going to pick up yards. He's going to set a tone for what the team is. And in this day and age where running backs are now, you know, they're not considered to be as important as they were a few years ago. They're all basically the same in terms of how many yards they'll pick up. Where they differ is in terms of the attitude and the presence that they can give.
Okay, I got one more, John. Last question.
Then we have to let him go because I'm sure he has to go home and go to sleep. Yes.
So, as good as the Seahawks looked yesterday, we did not look any better than the LA Rams, who are introducing a brand new superstar quarterback. The San Francisco, they looked pretty dominant for about 95% of that game, and Arizona kicked some butt. I know that we always say we're the toughest division in football, but we might have three or four of the best teams in the top seven or eight in the entire league. Do you think that'll hold up?
Well, first of all, did you actually watch any of those games or even highlights, or did you just read about them like normal?
That sort of smack talk might fly over there. You don't do that to Tom. You don't do that to Tommy T.
I've seen France. Highlights galore. Tom's,
yes, thank you, Tom. Thank you. Sorry,
but reading does give you more information.
Yes.
Tom treats sports like Reader's Digest, where he likes the good criticism of what happens without actually having to be bothered to watch the games. But he happens
to be right
in this case. All three teams were fantastic, and this is the best division in football, at least based on, you know, 1 week. All four teams dominated their opponent, and they may have all played lousy opponents when it's all said and done. We'll find out over the course of the year how good the four teams are that they beat. But it's hard to find a weakness in any of them. In Arizona, who's supposed to be the weakest of the four teams, their quarterback had four passing touchdowns and a rushing touchdown. And Chandler Jones, their defensive end, had five sacks in the game. they're supposed to be the weakest team in the division. So it does show you the kind of strength that you're up against this year.
Who are you more scared of, L.A. or San Francisco for the Seahawks?
It's a good yes, I think is the answer. I mean, I think if you're a Seahawks fan, you should have some fear and worry about, honestly, all three of these teams right now. But if you can split in your division, the other teams you play this year, the NFC or the AFC South is really bad. You already got to see one of their four teams. You play the NFC North; they didn't look very good either. Mm. So, you know, if you split in your division, you're right. Stay perfect at home. Maybe drop the games on the road. You have a really good chance to be one of the better teams in football.
Okay, Mike Sock, we appreciate your time, and I like the fact that you're no longer our boss, so we can make fun of you.
Yeah, good. That's
like we never stopped.
Really stopped.
Well, Tom, there were a couple times I got called into his office, and he's like, "Yeah, don't appreciate that." But now, gloves off, Sock.
Thank you. There we go. All right.
Let him try to take you to town, Tom. You watch the game. You
he's
just
got this running.
It.
He's got this running gripe with me.
He does.
The fact that I read the sports pages, I think it's because he's a radio guy and not a writer that he resents anybody who bases their information on newspapers.
Right.
He's
don't read the Times. Don't read the Tacoma Tribune. That they don't know what they're talking about over there, do they?
I don't have time to watch all the games like he does. I have a real job. Imagine a job where you just have to talk sports all day.
Woo!
Come on.
Wow. Look at Bob.
You never have to go to work.
Jeez. You'd fit right in with the Supreme Court. Justice Breyer was talking about the fact that people are I think the Wall Street Journal spoke to him, a bunch of other people as well. And Breyer, who's been in there since 93, I think, was talking about the fact that, yes, he is aware that people want him to retire. He knows. I mean, a lot of people, this is it. This is your time. Get out now. Get out. Please get out now. Time is ticking. Please leave. And he was on with Chris Wallace talking about it. And he said, you know, it's political realities and when to retire, when not to retire. I don't know if there's a cut in here that I like. Let's see. This.
Do you agree with Scalia that a justice who is unmindful of the politics of the president who replaces him, who's unmindful of that, is a fool?
I don't intend to die on the court. I don't think I'll be there forever. But I've said a few of the considerations previously, and
do you think the consideration that Scalia mentioned, I don't want to be replaced by somebody who's going to undo everything that
I've
done?
That I've undo everything I've done?
Yeah.
I see the point, and probably in your background there's could be something. There are many considerations, many considerations.
Did you get a chance to read his piece in the Wall Street Journal? They talked to him, Tom?
Yes, I did.
I tell you, the one thing that stuck out, and I thought, oh, Tom is going to love this, and I do too. Breyer says, when we sit around the table to talk about a case, we don't, the way this court works, we don't sit there and blast away at each other with an argument and say, well, my argument's better than your argument, right?
Yeah.
And he said, what we do is you hear the argument and then you try to see the reason of that person's argument and then pick up from their argument and find some sort of consensus or something within the argument that the person is making, as opposed to people blasting away these sort of bazooka shots back and forth. My words, not his. But I like the way he described how they come to something of a consensus on these cases, and that he says as much as they don't like to see a 5-4 verdict on them. But I enjoy to know that that's the way the Supreme Court operates, that's the way they look at these cases.
Yeah, in fact, I like the idea that the court always is looking for ways to avoid 5-4 decisions.
Yes, yeah.
That's really interesting because those are the ones that are always the juiciest, the most frustrating if you're on the 4 side and most exhilarating when you're on the 5 side. And he says, yeah, that in effect, it feels like they've failed. And as he points out, even when you win, so let's say you win, if it's a 5-4 case, you don't know how history will judge. He says, we've made mistakes. The court has made mistakes throughout the years. And just because you won, you know, in quotation marks, doesn't mean that you were right. And that's part of the problem. One of the things that he's unlike Scalia, because basically it was a good kind of taunt on Chris Wallace's part, was Scalia was very political. He was very aware of not wanting to have his legacy undone, like Amy Coney Barrett looks like she's on the verge of doing with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Breyer will not play that game. He is not partisan. I'm not saying that Scalia is necessarily partisan, because I think his arguments are always intellectually justifiable in his, you know, with his judicial philosophy. Mm-hmm. But he's certainly aware of the political consequence of what he's doing, and he doesn't want that to be taken down. I don't think that Scalia would want to be replaced by a guy like Stephen Breyer. I think Stephen Breyer wouldn't mind nearly as much if he was replaced by Scalia, as long as Scalia has a rationale for what he's doing.
Right.
And he does admit in the Wall Street Journal article, he says, listen, I understand the political machinations that led to the 6-3 conservative majority. And he says, what are you going to do about it? Basically, I think we're going to be, the liberals are going to be left with, you know, blistering dissents for, you know, for the near future.
Sure.
Because of the makeup of the court.
Right.
And then
the
he just kind of shrugs.
Right.
And says,
it's
that's
like,
the way
this
of
is
the
it.
World.
We have elections, yeah. And this is what happens in elections. Plus, it's not a red-blue. He was saying it's more the idea, yes, of originalists, the people that see the Constitution and don't try to read in between. These are, again, he didn't say this in the Wall Street Journal, but he has said this in other interviews as well, that it's not a red blue, not conservative, not Republican, not Democrat. It's originalists that take the words of the Constitution, or those that see it as a living, breathing, changing document that needs to reflect the times differently. And that is, you know, more the liberal side of it as opposed to the conservative side of it. So right now, at this point, he says he has no intention of retiring. He's not going to leave. And his last funny line, which I thought you'd like as well, from the Wall Street Journal, he goes, look, what am I going to do? I'm never going to write the great American novel. So he doesn't want to die at the court. But at the same time, he still feels he can still continue to do good work here. But he is the one that everybody's pushing to get out. The other question is, like, it's no one's going to say that Clarence Thomas, who has served in there almost as long as Breyer, no one's to say that his health is so great, too. I mean, there's some point he could step away. So,
well, there was actually speculation, if you remember, at the near the end of this last campaign,
right,
with Trump, when it looked like Trump might lose, that there was some speculation that he would go as well.
Right.
One last little thing that he did say, he thinks basically we ought to keep the rules the way they are, don't pack the court and those kinds,
right,
of things. The one thing he did say was he would allow for term limits, but what he wants super long term limits, because he says he doesn't want somebody to be looking for another job after,
right,
they've been the Supreme Court justice, because that could, you know, influence the way they do things. So
yeah,
he's flexible. You know, his whole demeanor is so happy. And kind of, he reminded me of the Ed Wynn character in Mary Poppins. You know, the guy who floats up above the, in the room all the time. He has that kind of, almost a giggly approach. But for a guy who's in his mid-80s, he certainly seems sharp.
Yeah. I don't agree with him on a lot of his cases, some of the stuff I do like. But again, I like the attitude of understanding that unfortunately, it has become political. He doesn't like that the Supreme Court has become, it's just,
right,
part of the whole mess, which is not the way it was intended to be. All right, Tracy Taylor takes a look at traffic for us. How are we doing on a Monday? All right, Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. Is the president coming this way? I know he's in Boise. He stopped off in Boise. A bunch of people out there screaming and yelling, protesting the president.
He's heading
Boise.
To California.
Oh,
going to California. Buck up Newsom.
Oh,
I don't know if Newsom wants him.
Oh,
well, that's, he's campaigning with him tonight, I think.
Oh my gosh. Would you want him? Would you want Joe?
I don't know. I can't get a tea leaf reading of the California electorate right now. I mean, they heavily went for Biden, but I don't know that that's going to help Newsom.
Mm. Well, I guess what it does is it's really about turnout, right? Because these are being mailed to everybody, and it's totally off your election. And I guess it'll get news, and then maybe more people will end up filling out the ballot and sending the thing in, because they're just afraid that the only people who are going to be doing it are be those that are truly politically active. So maybe having the president come is enough. Hopefully he doesn't get greeted the way they've been cheering him at various football games across the United States. By the way, he was Boise. He just told a story about how his first job offer was at Cascade Lumber in Boise, Idaho, in 1960-something. So people are checking that out. Seems to be not true. But anyway, maybe Facebook.
What kind of offer? I mean, he's from Vermont and Delaware.
He's from Delaware. I don't know. Just work at... that's what he said, that he was going to get a job there. This is a nutty story. I was long, and I warned Jacob. I said, Tom's not going to be happy with this, but it's a very, very, very long article.
Yeah, it is very long.
And Wall Street Journal basically outing the fact that Facebook seems to have a secret
collection of people. The best way to describe it is if you ever go to a club in New York or LA or something, they've got the red, rope keeping everybody back. But then there is this secret door you could go through that you could get in. If you were a celebrity, you get in the other door, the side door. And then there was one party where everybody was there. Then there was another party. And it's like, how do you get to the other party where the real cool people are? It seemed like Facebook had set something up and said, okay, if somebody has, millions of followers and stuff, and they post something, let's not have them go through the normal algorithm that will pull or stop the post or shut them down or put them in, 3-day, timeout. So let those people will go into a special group, and then human beings will determine whether or not their post can stand. Is that sort of basically the way to sum the thing up?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, there's like a secret elite. Now, there are all sorts of great, because it's so long, John, they had chances to make millions of interesting points. One of them is there are now millions of us in that secret elite
5 million
group. Yeah, yes. I mean, it's like it's unbelievable how unselective they are and who qualifies for elite. But so I am not a big fan of Facebook. I think basically they have used our information against us to profiteer from it. And once that was exposed and people objected, they just said, "What, us? Why is that a problem?" We'll do our best to try to fix it. So I'm not a normal champion for Facebook. However, in this particular instance, I completely understand at least the impulse to do this. Mm-hmm. When you are, they have 3 billion users.
Okay.
They are monitoring supposedly 3 billion of us posting. Now, it makes sense to me that you have, in order to review that many messages, you have to have some kind of algorithm. You have to have some kind of, rules of the road for the humans that are involved. And the thing is, it makes a lot of sense. You can't really monitor 3 billion. And that would be an argument about breaking up Facebook. But as long as Facebook is this big, how are you going to do it? And it also makes sense that the impact of our decisions, let's say, as they say, they think 10% of their decisions are wrong. If 90% of us are unknown and they make a decision that's unfair to us, we can object, and maybe our 10 friends, or 16 followers can, raise hackles against Facebook, but that's it. But if you are Donald Trump and he was one of the guys in, in the elite sphere, or somebody like Neymar, a big Brazilian soccer star with 150 million followers himself, it just says, let's not
different
let that
rules. But Facebook was the democratization that everybody's voice gets heard. There are people that work at Facebook that have said, if I had known this was going on, I would have had a problem with it. It also seemed what happened was that there were groups of people that worked at Facebook that were allowed to put people in this category.
Yes.
Well, what happened was it looked like nobody was keeping track of how big it kept getting. So the story that they followed was this Brazilian soccer star who posted nude photos of a woman that he says was trying to blackmail him or in some way use what had happened between the two. Yeah. So then he said, well, here are some photos of her. Here she is nude. Here's this. It was up for a day. A lot of people screen grabbed it. So that would have never have normally been able to get passed, but it got passed because he has so many followers. So you get the idea that Facebook really plays fast and loose with its idea of, oh, no, we treat everybody the same.
Yes.
Obviously, they don't. And the reason they don't, as you point out, if you were to block that guy with his 100 million followers, it would cause a bigger problem than if you just sort of create a side road for this guy to be on.
Also, but also in defense of what Facebook's doing, they're just kicking it up a level to be looked at. Now, that stuff was taken down, but it was taken down after a 24-hour space where they had another level of people reviewing it. But that, in a lot of ways, that makes sense. Like, okay, are we really going to censor, say, the president of the United States? I mean, this is significant. It's one thing to censor Tom. It's another thing to censor the, so I understand that at that point you want to kick it upstairs, which gives it a 24-hour delay. They ended up making the same decision of kicking it off, but they just didn't do it quickly enough. And that, I think it's understandable. The problem is it's spun out of control. If you're going to have 3 billion users, maybe 5 million, elite people doesn't seem like much, arithmetically, but in terms of 5,000 people, that's just too many. You should have maybe a couple hundred that get that kind of special treatment,
Based on what? On what metric? 200 million followers or something
that? Well,
They have no trouble blocking Trump. They've got Trump and then this committee that they put together. The Wall Street Journal digs into this ridiculous committee that does the ruling on it.
Tom, all you need
is 24 hours. The Brazilian soccer player only needed 24 hours
to
show nude photos. They would never let nude photos go up. But for him, that's all they needed. He needed to vet. He vented it out. And then somebody screen grabbed it, shared it all over the place. So it got out. So now it's like, we let the horse out of the barn. Yeah, but we let him out. But we got him. We let him out.
I know.
And then we close the thing up back 24 hours later.
I agree completely. I mean, the thing is, I think that the impulse behind it made sense, but the real world impact didn't. And so you should be reassured, John,
that
Facebook says they're doing away with this. It's called whitelisting. Because one of the problems is this thing is flagged. Normally it would be flagged. Yeah, but they're in the VIP, so we'll have to check it. Well, one of the problems they realize is, because there's so many of them, it gets kicked upstairs and there's nobody upstairs to even look at the dang thing. And so even their system isn't operating properly. So they say they're going to try to do away with that. And the one thing they say, they still say, we're still not going to treat everybody the same. That's just not possible. Wow. We're just going to shrink that X check list to a more select few.
I see. Okay, good. Well, that's comforting.
And one last thing, too.
Yes.
Also, Wall Street Journal, all Wall Street Journal did was get access to Facebook. Produced all this for them. Facebook hired this group to investigate it, and so what has been leaked now is the results of the Facebook investigation into Facebook, which aired all their dirty laundry, and Wall Street Journal now has access to it. So,
okay,
that's good.
There we all. There, it's all out there. I'm sure most of our listeners are probably on that the X check list.
Well, all of your followers, I'm sure.
Oh my God!
That's the difference between you and me, John.
Right,
I'm
concerned.
Past that red velvet rope.
I know.
I don't.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. 1,000 people that write in. By the way, the people that do go to our Facebook page. I don't understand it. You hate me, and then you say nice things about Tom. Or you hate Tom, and you say nice things about Tom. Don't do that. Somebody wrote on there, why are you doing this? Because people are arguing back and forth. Look, don't go there for that. Go to the page to see Jacob eating a grilled cheese sandwich or me washing my clothes in a bucket. That's it, right? There's no need for this vitriol. Right? Come on, Jacob. Have you seen that?
I try not to look at the comments too closely, John.
Oh, please.
You make our show sound like a silly show, John.
Tracy Taylor's got traffic.
All right, here we go.
So sad over here. There's a little black squirrel running around calling Blackie, and he gets up into the attic, Tom. Same squirrel's been doing it for like a year now, and I always say to the dogs, go get him, go get him, and thinking they'll never get him.
Oh, no.
I know.
Don't
and I saw it. I know.
Him.
I saw it. They got him. I yelled, God, get off. And I went over. I saw him suffering. And I thought of that scene from House of Cards where he's like, he goes over and he breaks the dog's neck. You remember that scene? Yep. And the thing's
You're no this, Kevin Spacey thing, God.
No. So I got this. I'm looking around for something heavy to throw on him. I'm like, I'm just going to. Because he's suffering, Tom.
Yeah,
and Kevin Spacey's like, does. People have different types of courage or whatever. And he goes, he cracks the dog's neck. And, oh, my God, I go over. I'm about to drop this giant heavy metal plate on him. And he looks up at me. And he hops up and seems sort of stunned. And I'm like, go up the tree. And he slowly went up the tree. It's like, oh, my God. I'm telling you. I could never make it.
You're not cut out for the great of the West.
No, I'm okay with this. But like as a mercenary or like, I don't think I can make it as a spy, I've decided. Like James Bond?
Yeah, you're no James Bond.
I got all
Daniel
these guns.
Craig is relieved.
I got all these guns and I'm like, I can't shoot him with that. That's too big of a bullet. I'm just like, see him. Oh my God. Oh my Lord. I'm so sorry. Oh my dog. Stop it. Stop chasing the squirrel. Do we want 18-year-olds behind the wheel when it comes to truck driving? This is the question. Actually, it's brought up in this infrastructure bill. It's been kicking around. The idea is there's not enough people to drive trucks. That's a big problem. You make about $41,000 a year. So should we lower it and allow 18-year-olds to drive trucks? This is one of the questions. It's in the Wall Street Journal, and it seems like I like the part down at the bottom. I don't know if it's in this article or another one. This woman is in charge of the Trucking Association. She goes, I'm sorry, how many 17-year-olds see a truck go by and go, oh, I want to drive an 18-wheeler? She goes, it's just the audience, the people are not there. The 18-year-olds don't want to do it. Go ahead, you could drop it. It's not going to have anything to do with it. Plus, if they're smart enough to know that self-driving trucks are right around the corner.
Ah, that's interesting. You know, this article doesn't even get into that.
The big
dispute, they say this is splitting the trucking industry because right now a lot of blue-collar kinds of jobs are hurting, and it turns out that people that are into these kind of heavy-duty, blue-collar kind of jobs would rather do, say, construction than truck driving. It's less disruptive of your daily schedule. So one of the solutions offered, this is a pilot program that's been passed by the Senate in this infrastructure bill, says that, hey, why don't we lower it? You have to be, I think it's 22. Let's lower it to 18 to see if we can get more people involved, which is a good thing for a lot of people that need drivers. At the same time, the trucking industry says, no, it's not a driver supply problem. It's a retention problem. We have horrible conditions. We can't pay them enough, and it disrupts their lives too much. We need to somehow figure out a way to fix the industry and not just, all we're going to do is cycle through more 18 and 19-year-olds. And then they don't even mention the fact that, the lure of the road does not have the appeal it might have had for 18 and 19-year-olds, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
It's a tough job. There's people listening that do it, and, man, it is just, it's a grinder. The traffic is horrible, and the way people drive, and those truck drivers just have a hell of a time out there.
And it's disruptive of their family life, of them, their sleep, everything else. It's a tough, and I think that if they could get paid twice, if they were getting paid $80,000, it might justify the conditions under which you have to operate. But, you know, in the low 40s, that's a tough life.
It's hard. Tracy Taylor knows a lot of her tips come from truckers,
absolutely.
Right?